From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. Last week, we brought you a memorable conversation with noted linguist Professor Noam Chomsky on his views on the plight of the Palestinians and the growing boycott, divest, sanctions movement. Tonight, we air a response to that interview by Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of Electronic Intifada, and activist and Middle East expert Jeff Blankfurt. The conversation we had with Professor Chomsky was taped and aired in December 2009, and we taped the response by Ali Abu Nima and Jeff Blankfurt 2 weeks later. We invited Professor Chomsky back for this debate, but unfortunately he declined.
Last week on Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, we brought back a revealing conversation we had with Professor Noam Chomsky about his views on boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel and the plight of the Palestinians, a conversation we taped and aired in December of 2009. In January of 2010, we aired a response to that interview by Abu Ali Nima, co-founder of Electronic Intifada, an activist and Middle East expert, Jeff Blankfurt. We invited Professor Chomsky back for this debate, but he unfortunately declined. Here is a clip from the original interview with Professor Noam Chomsky, where Khalil asks Professor Noam Chomsky about his views on BDS movement.
You have consistently, is my understanding, opposed economic sanctions against Israel on practical and moral grounds. Would you please tell our listeners why you seem to oppose the BDS approach against Israel?
Well, I don't know what you're quoting, but I've always favored the BDS approach if it's applied sensibly. I mean, BDS is a very blunt instrument. We have to make a distinction between feel-good actions and do-good actions. We can do things that make us feel good, but may be harmful to the victims. Or we can do things that do good, and they quite typically involve compromises. There are quite significant differences between South Africa and Israel, but in both cases, you had to make a distinction between tactics that did good and tactics that just made you feel good. There's a lot of considerations that come up when you think about sanctions. For one thing is whether they are educational or whether they are miseducation. Now, sanctions against Israel can be educational, but very often they're miseducational.
Give us an example, if you'd win.
Well, let's say boycotting an Israeli dance group. Why not boycott a U.S. dance group? I mean, whatever the crimes that Israel commits are committed to the extent that the U.S. Not only tolerates them, but participates in them. And, playing a decisive role in Israel's crimes is a very minor footnote to U.S. crimes. So, therefore, boycotting an Israeli dance group immediately, I mean, apart from the question of selectivity, immediately offers jingoist hardline supporters of Israel an opening. It says, look, you're a total hypocrite. And unfortunately, they have a case. And I'm not in favor of giving support to hardline supporters of Israeli atrocities.
Are you in favor of the academic boycott, for example?
Boycott has to be done intelligently. For one thing, it has to be educational. It shouldn't mislead. And for another, it should be designed in such a way that it helps the victims rather than harming them. Any hardline supporter of Israeli crimes can claim with justice that it's completely hypocritical. I mean, do you boycott the U.S. institutions, academic institutions, which are involved in far greater crimes, along with the fact that they share enormous responsibility for Israeli crimes? Yeah, and when actions are taken that are so transparently hypocritical, yeah, it does offer a weapon to those who want to support hardline criminal actions. We should be honest, in other words. We should be honest, and we should consider carefully whether our actions are do good or feel good. That's a crucial difference, always. So, I mean, say, take the Vietnam War. I was very much involved in protest and, in fact, yes. resistance mm-hmm. to the war. However, there were acts of resistance that I opposed. So, for example, breaking windows in stores is a feel-good action, but it harms the Vietnamese.
Ali, what do you make of Chomsky's distinction between do good versus feel good? He says all these BDS tactics should be applied very, quote-unquote, sensibly, intelligently.
Well, I think he's absolutely right about that. And I think that the, by and large, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel has made those distinctions and has been very careful about calling for actions which are not only morally justified, but likely to be effective. So I would agree with that. Where I would disagree with him is on the examples he gave, which really seem not to leave any room at all for boycott, divestment, and sanctions in the case of Israel. For example, he talked about one shouldn't boycott a dance group. Well, you know, that's a very easy case to make if we think that dance is just about culture and is innocent of politics. But that's not the case at all here, because we know, because Israeli government ministers have said it publicly many times, that Israel is using cultural tours by dance groups and other cultural groups sponsored by the Israeli government to burnish the image of Israel. So if we're saying that we're not going to protest those groups, we're not going to have boycott actions directed against Israeli government propaganda tours, then what we're saying is that we should give free rein to Israeli government propaganda and allow them to use dance and other forms of art and film as a way to whitewash Israel's image, so that the American public can think Israel is this lovely place which produces nothing but lovely modern dance, while unseen and unheard are the voices of people in Gaza and other parts of Palestine. I think it would be pretty immoral if we left the field open to Israeli government-sponsored misuse of culture and art for propaganda purposes.
Now, when it comes to the academic boycott, what did you think of his argument there that somehow, even at that level, you need to be very careful and discriminate between doing good and feeling good?
Well, I agree with that. And that's why I always point people to the guidelines which have been issued by the Boycott National Committee in Palestine, the guidelines for applying the academic and cultural boycott, and they're available on websites like BDSmovement.net and PACB.org. Those are the websites, respectively, of the Boycott National Committee in Palestine and the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott. And these guidelines make a very clear distinction about what is being boycotted and what isn't. So we're not boycotting someone just because they're an Israeli. The boycott is aimed at Israeli institutions, and there is a great deal of evidence that these institutions are very directly involved in the military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in Israel's military industry. For example, just recently, Israel had a huge propaganda coup because one of the scientists at the Weizmann Institute won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. But what wasn't mentioned in any of the media coverage is that the Weizmann Institute in Israel is one of the chief, if not the main, places for the development of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons in Israel. Tel Aviv University as well has very close ties to the defense industry. And other universities like the Hebrew University have been directly involved in ethnic cleansing and displacing Palestinians from their homes in order to take over their land. So Well, there's very direct complicity by Israeli institutions. And I think there's also a moral element here because, again, once again, Israeli institutions, by virtue of the enormous support that the United States gives to Israel, people as Israeli institutions have enormous access to academic and other resources in the United States through joint programs, some of them government-sponsored and funded, whereas Palestinian academics or anyone at a Palestinian academic institution, foreign scholar or a foreign student, can't necessarily have that sort of access. So there is a moral case to be made to saying that we want to end the separate and unequal access to education and research that is the direct result of Israeli government policy and restrictions on Palestinian education, research, and travel and so on. So it would seem to me that if there is any case anywhere in the world for academic boycott, Israel fits the criteria to a T.
And what did you think about his example of a counterproductive tactic when I asked him for one, when he cited breaking store windows? Is that a fair comparison with...
Well, I thought that, you know...
with a nonviolent tactic like BDS.
Well, I thought that that was very strange that he should bring that up, because the whole point of BDS is it is nonviolent, and it is about having a direct impact on Israeli institutions and Israeli society to get them to change their behavior. And what I find strange is that someone of Professor Chomsky's depth and knowledge should not be aware of how effective these sorts of tactics have been. You talked with him about South Africa, where it's clear that the global BDS movement had a very important role. But here in the United States, the civil rights movement used boycott to great effect. There are other examples around the world. In the case of Northern Ireland, there were BDS-like tactics, the McBride principles, which aimed at discriminatory hiring and so on. So there's a long history here that we can look at, and we can say, well, what is likely to work and what isn't? And the good thing is the BDS movement, by and large, is doing that, having those discussions and debates. So I find it really quite misleading, and I would say disrespectful, to dismiss the BDS movement and all the work it's done as being somehow just a feel-good movement. I think that's very, very dismissive and misleading. Palestinian society has called for a boycott of Israeli institutions. It hasn't called for a boycott of American universities. So it's also not just about what we here in the U.S. decide, but it's also about taking a lead from those people who are struggling for their rights. And Palestinians have given a clear lead on BDS, saying, these are the tactics we want you to employ. This is what we think can really help us to achieve liberation. And I think there's a moral imperative to answer those calls.
Now we'll hear another excerpt from the interview I had with Professor Chomsky.
If there's enough engaged, dedicated popular pressure, it can affect policy. And this one happens to be a pretty easy one.
Well, if it was that easy, we're 62 years later, we're still at square one.
63 years later. It has to do, the consensus does not have to do with 1948. That's a separate question. The consensus has to do with 1967 and post-67.
Ali Abu Nima. Professor Chomsky contends that worldwide consensus is for a two-state solution in Palestine. What is the international consensus on the desirability of two states, Ali, if there is such a consensus?
Well, I think that it's quite shocking that Chomsky should dismiss 1948. It's very much part of the consensus among Palestinians. Palestinians were the people displaced in 1948. They have not closed the file on what has happened to them, because the Nakba that started in 1948 continues to this day. Millions of Palestinians are still displaced. They've still lost their past, present, and future because of what happened in 1948. And so to dismiss it like that is really rather callous. But what it indicates is that Chomsky is taking his lead on what should be the important issues from Israel, from the United States, and from those in power, which is really quite uncharacteristic from someone who has always been in solidarity with people fighting against imperialism and fighting against colonialism. I mean, this notion of a consensus, that there's a consensus for a two-state solution, it's fine on paper, but you have to look at the reality, and I wonder if Chomsky has really grappled with the reality on the ground, which is, as Meron Benvenisti, the Israeli scholar, calls it, a de facto binational state. And I think you have to assume the moral consequences when you call for a two-state solution, because a two-state solution is actually a repartition of Palestine. It's a repartition of a country where you have 11 million people, and you cannot easily draw a line between them. Every single case of partition or repartition in history has always led to enormous bloodshed and enormous displacement of people. And I would argue and I would predict that an attempt to repartition Palestine now would be no less bloody, no less unpredictable, and no less disastrous than 1948. Now, I could be wrong about that. You could make all kinds of counter-arguments against what I've just said. But the point I'm making is that to simply ignore that possibility and to argue blithely that this is what the international consensus says, and I'm not going to be concerned about the possible consequences, I'm not going to be concerned about the injustice done to Palestinian refugees, the fact that this consensus is terribly unjust, it calls for a Palestinian state on a fraction of Palestine, when Palestinians are once again becoming the majority population in the country. So what I'm saying is that a two-state solution is not a simple question morally, politically, or practically, but the kind of arguments that Chomsky puts forward make it sound as if it's a no-brainer, as if it's very easy, and it doesn't grapple with the issue of fundamental rights, which we're getting into, as people understand that what we have is not a question of Palestinians lacking a state, but a question of Palestinians lacking the most basic rights, whether they're in Israel, whether they're in the occupied territories, or whether they're refugees denied their right to return to their homeland just because they have the wrong religion or wrong ethnicity as far as Israel is concerned. So I don't think that anyone who's serious about resolving this conflict can simply ignore and dismiss those issues and say, well, there's an international consensus. There have been international consensuses over a lot of things that have been very, very wrong that Chomsky would have opposed, but he didn't just say, well, there was an international consensus, so we should abandon our moral claims, our political struggles, and our analysis and our knowledge of history. If you'd gone back to 1950 in the United States, you would think that white supremacy and white power were immovable, and nothing could really challenge them, and nothing could bring civil rights. And so you might have said, well, you have to settle and make compromises. The same in South Africa. For a long time, it looked as if the apartheid regime were unmovable, and the situation could never change. So I think it's very dangerous when you start to go down that road of simply deciding what those in power will accept should be the ceiling of your demands, especially when they're morally and politically justified.
Electronic Intifada co-founder Ali Abu Nima speaking with Khalil Bendib. When we come back, Khalil will get the reaction of Jeff Blankford, photojournalist and Middle East analyst, about Professor Chomsky's remarks on the role of Israeli lobby in influencing U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Israel-Palestine. We invited Professor Chomsky back for this debate, but he declined. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa from KPFA in Berkeley and online at kpfa.org. We'll be back in a minute. Lazan, and this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. In a minute, we'll get the reaction of photojournalist and Middle East analyst Jeff Blanford to Professor Chomsky's remarks about the role of Israeli lobby in influencing U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Israel, Palestine. But first, here is Professor Chomsky responding to Khalil's question about the role and the significance of the Israeli lobby.
Just think about what you're saying. If the media, and that means, you know, they typically the intellectual class that they represent, if they are strongly supporting Israeli crimes and U.S. participation in them, as for the most part they are, then what's a lobby? I mean, is the lobby the whole take the corporate sector? I mean, they very strongly support U.S. Israeli crimes. High-tech investment in Israel is going way up. Intel, you know, the major chip manufacturer, happens to be building its major new plant to construct a new generation of chips in Israel, and that's just one part of a large-scale corporate investment. Lockheed Martin is strongly supports a U.S. Provision of fighter jets, bombers to Israel, and so on. Well, if that's the lobby, then the whole
establishment.
Then all power centers are the lobby.
Yes. To me, that's why I don't like to use the term lobby, because it's very restricted to just one facet of this whole.
Well, but then I don't understand what we're talking about for almost half a century. I've been writing, speaking, and condemning the support of the intellectual classes, the media. I don't bother with corporate interests. They have their own concerns. For the U.S. policy of supporting and participating in Israeli criminal actions.
Yes.
That's exactly what I've been doing for years. So
yes,
question.
And I'm aware of that, but there seems to be a taboo which has to do with the unfortunate in the history of anti-Semitism, and it's still in the background, it's still making a lot of people rather uncomfortable with talking about certain topics. People who have an emotional commitment to Israel is not just strictly dollars and cents.
Right, and there are plenty. But you see, and there are plenty of people who have that commitment, just as they have the same commitment to supporting U.S. crimes elsewhere.
That's right.
Okay, so and that's exactly what I and I suppose you know anybody serious about these matters is always talking about.
But my original question, and where you seemed to be puzzled by my question, is the fact that there are a lot of people like this, the head of Intel, or whether it be Starbucks or many other corporations, or even within the labor unions. The labor unions have been some of the most egregious examples of support and conditional support to Israel.
I've been writing about that for years, and I've been writing about the fact that what they're doing, for example, putting pension funds in Israel is probably flatly illegal.
Right.
So why are you telling me what I write and speak about all the time?
My question was, there seems to me people like Noam Chomsky and other intellectuals in this country who are very uncomfortable bringing up this one dimension, which is...
You mean the one that I talk about all the time?
No.
I'm uncomfortable about bringing it up.
No, the one that has to do with ethnic loyalty, which is a taboo.
There's an element of ethnic loyalty, particularly since 1967.
Right.
Since 67, and I've been writing about it ever since then.
Hmm.
So what is the question?
The question is that element of ethnic loyalty, and many groups have such loyalty, does that not constitute a major element that needs to be talked about, even though I understand it brings up the question of anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I talk about it all the time for just that reason. And in fact, I'm one of those who's regularly condemned as an anti-Semite.
Yes, I've heard,
so
I've heard
I
that.
I simply don't understand what you're asking. This is what I speak and do about all the time. Now, of course, we want to place that, the effect of that ethnic loyalty, we want to measure it accurately.
Yes.
Not just raise it to a power way beyond what it had, so that we should be accurate, in other words. So to what extent is the effect of the ethnic loyalty significant, and to what extent is the general attitude of, intellectuals in the media since 1967 significant, and that has nothing to do with ethnic loyalty. For example, I mean, take, say, the New York Times, which you mentioned.
Yes.
Yes, it's a strong Jewish element in it. In fact, Jewish owned. It was non-Zionist until 67. Okay. Mm-hmm. After 67, it's strongly Zionist. Take a journal like Dissent, on the left. I mean, until 1967, Irving Howe and others were either ignored Zionism or had contempt for it. After 1967, they very strongly supported it. Okay, so that raises the question, well, what happened in 1967? And there's an answer. I wrote about it at the time. Others have, too. And that gets us into the factors that are leading to U.S. support for Israel.
Jeff, when I asked Professor Chomsky whether he feels the Israeli interests in this country, including the Israel lobby, are instrumental in inflecting or deciding U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, he had this to say.
Professor Chomsky says that he writes about certain things all the time. This doesn't happen to be true. He has talked about the media. I don't recall him speaking about the pension funds or the trade unions all the time. When he speaks about the media and the intellectuals, what he forgets to mention that the overwhelming majority of these folks in the media, the columnists, the media, happen to be Jewish. And that since the very beginning of the lobby, which is a bad term, actually, because it's more of a hotel with a lobby in it, a hotel with hundreds of rooms, of which the lobby is only one, the media is another. And the media, since Israel's inception, has played a major role in shaping U.S. public opinion and foreign policy. It works in tandem with the lobby. In fact, it is lobbying the general public and the government through television network programs, through the columns in the New York Times, Boston Globe, the Washington Post, that are syndicated around the country. You have Richard Cohn, you have Charles Krauthammer, you have Tom Friedman, you have Bill William Kristol, Jeff Jacoby, David Brooks. When these columns appear in the New York Times, the Washington Post, they then are found in papers all across the United States. So you see that it isn't just the intellectual elite. This is the line that the whole American public gets. Chomsky ignores this. Also, he talks about the New York Times a lot, not being Zionist till 67. The New York Times, from the very beginning, has given Israel most positive kind of publicity. So the fact that it was Zionist or not Zionist is irrelevant because it supported the state of Israel, and largely uncritically. So this is like a trying to shift the action away to pretend that the lobby is something and the media is something else when they're intimately connected.
And I noticed how he seemed not interested in talking about this ethnic element that's at play. The fact that perhaps it's not just about imperialism, perhaps not entirely about oil in the Middle East, but maybe there's something else, and that's the taboo you don't talk about.
Well, it's interesting. He doesn't like to talk about the ethnic element. And sometimes he compares the Israel lobby to the Armenian lobby, to the Turkish lobby, to the Irish lobby, and so on, which obviously there's no comparison. But he said in 67 that he was afraid that Israel would be destroyed. And that's an indication to me of his deep commitment to Israel's existence as a Jewish state. As a matter of fact, he has been adamantly against a single state for the very same reason that the mainstream Zionist movement is against it, because Jews would eventually become a minority. And he's written this.
He claims that the reason he's against a one-state solution is they're just not practical, that it's, as he calls it, a feel-good proposition versus a do-good. The two-state solution would be, according to him.
That's the way he frames it. But when you put together his other positions, one, he's also has been against the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and now evidently he says it's okay, but unless it's coupled with a campaign against stopping Israeli arms sales, it's a diversion. Now, what's interesting is that up to now, he has never advocated in his talks anything that activists could actually do to stop Israeli occupation and change situations, such as ending arms sales to Israel. Now he's talking about that needs to be coupled with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Otherwise, boycott, divestment, and sanctions are a diversion. Now, what's interesting, the difference is boycott, divestment, and sanctions are a grassroots campaign, do not require any politician support, whereas the members of Congress, who he dismisses and doesn't talk about, doesn't write about, Congress is the body that votes the money and the arms to Israel. And so the ability of the movement to move Congress to do that is remote. But what he's saying, we shouldn't go and boycott, divest, or implement sanctions against Israel unless we also get Congress to stop arms sales to Israel. So this is a little ingenuous on Professor Chomsky's part.
I asked him about the Congress and how come Congress seems to be so incredibly disciplined when it comes to the one issue of Israel. And that, to my knowledge, no other issue unites different ideologies that you see among members of the Congress. Nothing unites the Congress like the issue of Israel. And he denied that.
Well, he may deny that. He has been distorting U.S.-Israel relations for so many years that it's not surprising. But there is no other critical issue in which the most liberal member of the Democratic Party, such as Barbara Boxer, for example, will lock arms with the most right-wing Republican, ultra-right-wing Republican, and they will consistently do that and have been doing that over the years. Even the cast of characters has changed, but not the willingness of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to lock arms over that issue almost unanimously, and there's no other critical issue that enjoys the same kind of support. But Chomsky does not talk about that. The late Professor Israel Shahak, back in 1991, in a letter to me, when I wrote to him complaining about Chomsky dismissing the power of the lobby and its involvement in the first Gulf War, not to mention the second Gulf War. Shahak, who knew Chomsky very well, they were friends, indeed was the one who pushed Chomsky, by Chomsky's own admission, into speaking about the Middle East in the first place. Shahak wrote to me, he says, "No doubt what you write is true. Chomsky does help AIPAC." And I put that in an article that I wrote that was published in Left Curve. I hesitated for quite some years to publish that, but after I read an article, an interview with Professor Chomsky, in which he opposed boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel because, get this, the Israeli public would oppose it, not the Palestinians, but the Israelis would oppose it, and also was opposed to describing the situation in the West Bank and Gaza at the time as apartheid, because apartheid is a very different thing, when we all know that people who don't understand the Palestinian-Israeli issue, they do want to know what apartheid means. So I find it also very problematic when Professor Chomsky does not want to use the term apartheid when discussing Israel and the Palestinian situation.
By the way, I should mention here to our listeners that I did invite Professor Chomsky to debate you and to debate Ali Abu Nima, which would have been my first choice. And he just declined that offer.
In 1991, when Chomsky and I were on friendly terms, we had opposing articles in a newspaper called the National Guardian out of New York, in which afterward a mutual friend asked Professor Chomsky and myself if we would debate each other at the Socialist Scholars Conference in New York in 1992. Chomsky declined, saying, quote, "It wouldn't be useful." The question is, useful to whom or not useful to whom? Mm-hmm. Again, before I wrote this article, Professor Chomsky was asked by the same person if he would debate me, and again, he declined to do that. And he said, it's not something he writes about. It's something that I write about, but he doesn't write about it. He says, I don't write about it. I don't talk about it. Last April, there was a debate at MIT, and he was invited to debate a Palestinian student, a graduate student, and he said that talking about the lobby is a distraction, and he's not interested in talking about it. So it's interesting. He says he writes about all these things, but he doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to debate it. The labor union situation is very interesting. The labor unions have been a cornerstone of support for Israel in the United States even before the state was born. Wolf Blitzer, who people may know from CNN, was a former staff member of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which certainly qualifies him to be a CNN reporter. He wrote an article for Hadassah Courier, Jewish Woman's Journal, in 1983, in which he began with a sentence, "In the lobby of the AFL-CIO headquarters in Washington, D.C., there is a statue of Golda Meir, the former Israeli prime minister." And he said, "That is not surprising, because next to the American Jewish community itself, the American labor movement is the strongest supporter of Israel in the United States." And this was a very revealing document. It talked about the amount of money that the unions have invested in Israel bonds, something I should say that I've never heard Professor Chomsky talk or see him write about. And that even though today the labor unions have very few Jewish workers, many of the labor union leaders are still Jewish, and they are all, to a man, loyal to Israel. They may disagree with each other, but when it comes to Israel, they are as loyal as any Democrat in Congress. And this is very critical because 1,700 labor unions have invested millions of dollars, members' pension funds, in Israeli bonds, which in effect make them obligated to lobby for Israel to make sure that Israel makes good on those bonds.
What about Noam Chomsky's position that Israel is really a client state that's useful to the U.S. imperial ambitions in the Middle East? That is really what determines U.S. policy in the Middle East.
Well, Chomsky makes a point of this, and those on the left who don't want to deal with the issue of the lobby try and make a point of this. But the historical record does not support this. I have been working on a book on the lobby trying to find evidence of some public statesman, people in the State Department, people in the Pentagon who saw Israel as a strategic asset. It's almost impossible to find anyone. In fact, Israel appears more as some giant obstacle or road that can't be removed, that has to be dealt with. And this is what one presidency after another has had to do. That simply because of what they call domestic considerations, because of the pressure and power of the organized Jewish establishment here, no president can afford to spend the political capital that is required to battle the Israel lobby.
Just to reinforce what you were saying, I was quite disconcerted, to put it mildly, at Noam Chomsky's denial, total denial of even recent history. For example, the fact that Obama clearly has been at least trying to impose some kind of a settlement freeze on Netanyahu. But Chomsky just denied that, and he quoted some obscure spokesperson for the White House whose name he couldn't recall.
It's quite dishonest. What Chomsky will not mention is that before Netanyahu, Obama would meet Netanyahu, 76 U.S. senators and 330 members of the House sent letters crafted by AIPAC to Obama telling him not to put pressure on Netanyahu, and then during the congressional recess, 55 members of Congress, 30 Democrats, including the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, went to Jerusalem and took the side of Netanyahu against Obama, particularly when it came to East Jerusalem, in which Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, said Israel has every right to settle whatever it wants to do in East Jerusalem. One president after another has been humiliated by Israel, and we've seen Obama's been humiliated a number of times. It's been a worldwide story. And Chomsky insists that American policy is to maintain the occupation. He gives not a shred of evidence to support it.
You have been listening to an interview with Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of Electronic Intifada, an activist and Middle East expert, Jeff Blankford. To listen to this interview and our original interview with Professor Noam Chomsky, please visit kpfa.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.